Welcome to Federalist 2.0. This is a new podcast where we explore the ways in which the Constitution, our instruction manual for how to run a government, could be improved. I'm your host, Jeff, and you can reach me at federalistreboot@gmail.com. Now, on with the show. For all the influence that the executive has in our lives, it's almost criminally under-discussed within the Constitution itself. We're going to talk about the role we see for the executive branch with the benefit of a couple centuries of experience. This episode won't get into a lot of the nitty-gritty of the proposed restructure, but more lay out the current state of things and address the areas of concern. Hope you enjoy. As I said in the intro, the 1787 Constitution is pretty spare in its discussion of the executive branch. Article 2 contains only four sections. The first concerns how the president is elected, his qualifications, how he's paid, and what his oath of office is. Section 2 makes him commander-in-chief, gives him the power to make treaties with the consent of the Senate, and the power to fill vacancies. Section 3 is a weird section that has a grab bag of things, including the State of the Union, allows him to recommend laws, which seems like a weird thing to even prescribe, convene Congress and adjourn them under certain circumstances, among other things. And Section 4 simply says he's removed upon impeachment. But that's it. So it's no wonder, given that the concept of the unitary executive that we discussed in the last episode has cropped up. It's not a wholly unreasonable opinion to have regarding the Constitution's construction of executive authority. There's really not much. It doesn't talk about an executive branch really at all. So why wouldn't people assume that the framers intended the executive to sort of reside and rest within one person with a cadre of people there to support him? Let's quickly lay out the broad roles of the executive branch. The first and most famous is that of commander-in-chief. America has held firm to our commitment of having a civilian-led military for over two centuries. The president is commander-in-chief, and the person in charge of the day-to-day operations of the military is, likewise, a civilian. In fact, the Department of Defense employs over 700,000 civilians as compared to 1.3 million active duty service members, so the role of commander-in-chief is pretty important. Then there's the role that's probably most relevant to all of our day-to-day lives, that of the execution of the laws of the United States. The president is, first and foremost, the one in charge of ensuring that the laws passed by Congress actually mean something, that they're obeyed by themselves and by the citizenry. The third role that comes up is just as important as the other two, but it's one that we typically forget. The president's America's first and most prominent ambassador with other nations. All ambassadors ultimately report to the chief executive. Now, there's some other roles, too, that the president's imbued with, suggesting laws to Congress, addressing Congress regarding the State of the Union, presiding over the Senate, and that's the vice president, obviously, pardoning people and convening and adjourning Congress. What do we do with all these powers? Well, as we've discussed previously, the diffusion of political power is pretty important for any governing body to function well. However, there's an inevitable danger of having important decisions determined by committee. So ultimately, the balance we need to strike is to have diffuse power while still having sufficient responsibility for the individuals making the decisions. This was probably the biggest blind spot for the framers, I think. With the benefit of a couple hundred years of history and experience with psychology and social sciences, we know three things now about how groups make decisions. Generally, groups make better decisions than individuals. Groups that make decisions often lack the individual's sense of responsibility necessary to make them feel accountable for those decisions. And groups can frequently be dominated by a single commanding individual, which renders the benefits of that group decision meaningless, while still providing that committee as a shield from the responsibility for the commanding individual. So with those three things in mind, let's talk about the pain points we've experienced over the last several decades. Now, I think probably the biggest and most fractious is also the one that's the most critical to nail down correctly, so it's the one we're going to start with, and that's war. Congress has the authority to declare war, but the president is the commander-in-chief. What does that mean? Well, you'd be tempted to read that and think, okay, well, only Congress can authorize going into combat, but the president runs the show once we get there. It's a totally reasonable interpretation. I think that's what the framers probably intended, and it's what most people would expect to be the case. But it's not the way things are right now, because Congress has changed that, and here's the reason. Congress recognized that there might be fast-moving circumstances that the president needed to react to, and that as commander-in-chief, he shouldn't have to get congressional approval to, as an example, defend against an invasion, right? If the British show up on the shores of Florida, the president ought to be able to authorize the troops to fight back from that invasion without having to convene Congress. You can see how that would be necessary, especially in a world in which, you know, even in the 40s and 50s, when telecommunication wasn't the way it is, and Congress would recess for months on end. So they've given the commander-in-chief the authority to engage in limited action, at least limited on paper, to respond to certain actions, and then the president is supposed to come back to the Congress for additional authority or for a formal declaration of war. But those declarations of war don't automatically lapse, and they're not subject to review or renewal by future Congresses. In fact, even in 2020, the U.S. is still operating under a war on terror declaration from after 9/11. War declarations can, and I think have, gotten out of hand. Additionally, the president has that authority to do things that maybe instigate a war, right? If the president believes they're defending against an imminent attack and then bombs somebody first, preemptively, even if they're in the middle of gassing up planes set to go attack us, well, they've instigated that war and effectively tied Congress's hands, right? If Congress has the authority to declare war, I don't think anyone would presume that if someone declares war on us, the president doesn't have the right to fight back. So, you know, the president having the authority to unilaterally do things that might be sort of effectively a declaration of war is problematic. And on top of all of that, when we do have a formal declaration of war, the president has pretty much unfettered authority to prosecute that war as they see fit. So that is the crux of the problem. That's an awful lot of power that has been sort of divested from Congress and pushed into the presidency. We also have a similar issue with emergency declarations. These emergency declarations have proven to be pretty never-ending, in some cases literally never-ending, as we're still technically, apparently, as I did research on this, under a 1979 emergency declaration by President Carter regarding Iran, a fact that probably comes as a surprise to literally everyone who's listening to this podcast. So for these reasons, I think that the executive branch really should be broken up into multiple individuals with their roles clearly delineated, but also serving, I think maybe even more importantly, as checks and balances and backups for each other. I envision three distinct roles within the government. The first is that the new presidency is a more limited role than the overly expansive one that we know of today. I envision a return to an executive whose job is focused like a laser on executing the laws, running the government. The apparatus of the federal government should flow up through the president by way of a cabinet. These cabinet members should be appointed by the president and generally should serve at the pleasure of the president. I think there's a way to craft at least a semi-independent department within the executive. We'll talk a little bit more about that as we go on. But I think generally they should serve at the pleasure of the president, because I think the president should be permitted to pick cabinet members as they see fit and that align with their goals for that department. This is a president that presumably will have run on a certain platform. They'll have won election. They have some level of mandate from the populace. And so picking individuals who align with their way of thinking on these policy issues seems pretty reasonable. The second role, what we'll call the prime minister, will be to oversee the military and foreign affairs. I think vesting military and diplomacy within one individual makes a lot of sense. Those two things create a certain amount of healthy tension when you're trying to balance them. They allow the prime minister, when they run for office, to run on an explicit platform so that the populace can make a decision about how they view foreign affairs. If the country wants to be xenophobic, then so be it, I guess. You know, if they want to be expansive, then that's fine too. If they want to be cordial, as I expect that they will typically want to be, and relatively pacifist and non-interventionist, probably is a better term, then that's what they'll run on. I think that's the best way to balance this. And so I think treaty negotiations, ambassador appointments, and then obviously commander-in-chief would roll up to this prime minister. Then the third role, what I'm calling the chancellor, is somebody who's responsible for the approval of new laws and the appointment of judges to interpret those laws, right? So this third role is not a particularly active duty in terms of day-to-day responsibilities. So it's there where I would put the vice presidential roles in terms of the succession. The succession would be there in terms of who would accede to president and prime minister if something should happen. So I think the president and the prime minister are the more powerful active roles, and the chancellor is the one that then steps in if something happens. In this way, I think the president and prime minister never have the possibility of stepping into each other's positions. And because of that, they then ideally are colleagues who discuss, communicate, and even challenge each other, but ultimately have very little overlap. And then on top of that, I think segregating the execution of the laws with the passing of new laws is a core principle of our conception of separation from powers. And this creates an additional layer that I think we really need. If you look at typical European-style parliamentary governments, Britain is a good example. The people elect a parliament. That parliament then picks the person to then be prime minister. And the result is one of two generally unhealthy things. Either the prime minister is a lapdog to the parliament, knowing that they could just chop him off at any moment and appoint a new prime minister, or the prime minister is the sort of presumed leader of the parliament anyway, and now you have just no separation between them, between the executive and the legislature. So I think this is a good thing. And part of the reason is, I think one of the more infuriating facets of our current political system is the pandering that inevitably happens when we get a presidential election. The candidates will always fall all over themselves, making promises about things they'll deliver that are really legislative items that aren't presidential prerogatives. Partially, this is because presidents are perceived to be sort of the de facto heads of their respective parties, and that's something that we're seeking to diminish by other steps we've taken in terms of making the parties that are running for executive different parties than parties running for the legislature. But partly because uninformed individuals often just look to the most powerful person in the country or the most prominent person in the country for the solutions to their problems. So I think breaking those apart and breaking those duties up is something that could only be healthy. So the last thing we're going to talk about today, there are some new powers that we definitely want to vest within our more diffuse executive. You know, now that it is more diffuse, we can give a little bit more power to them. Especially, we should feel free to give powers to them that check other branches. First, I think the balance of power between the executive and the legislature with regards to advice and consent has gotten just out of whack. This is one of the few areas where the legislature has, in my opinion at least, sought and achieved a level of power and control far disproportionate to what the framers intended. Now, admittedly, there's a balance to strike here. Don't get me wrong, executives need to be held in check so that they can't just appoint wackadoodles, right? We don't want them appointing powerful individuals with views that are greatly divergent from the populace into positions that are difficult to remove them from. But they shouldn't also be held captive and prevented from exercising their constitutional duty by a legislature that disagrees with them politically. To allow a legislature to just deny the executive their required duties and responsibilities is to do, I think, violence to the Constitution itself. Let's talk about Merrick Garland, because I think this is the most clear example of this in recent history, right? For those that don't know, although I'm sure people listening to this do, but for those that don't, about a year before the 2016 election, Anthony Scalia passed away, a justice on the Supreme Court. The Mitch McConnell, the leader of the majority in the Senate, told the president, we're not gonna listen to any of your appointments. Obama appointed a relatively older and relatively more moderate justice than he probably would have appointed had he had his druthers. And the Senate just sat on it, right? Now, the legislature, I think, was totally within their rights to conduct a hearing and then vote against him. If they wanted to do that, that was perfectly fine. I'm not sure I'd have agreed with it, but it's fine. But I think they're far outside of their constitutional prerogative to just refuse to conduct a hearing and ignore the issue altogether. That's them refusing to do their constitutional responsibility. The 1787 Constitution creates one person who for 4 years is responsible for all federal judicial and executive appointments. That power rests within the executive, and it's only supposed to be softly checked by the legislature with their advice and consent role. If the framers had intended the legislature to be the be-all, end-all, and the ultimate arbiter of those appointments, they'd have just given the appointment rights to the House and the Senate. They didn't, right? So then the question is, how do we fix that? How do we return to that original idea of appointments by the executive that are intended to be given broad leeway and sort of softly checked by the chambers? Well, I think first and foremost, we should require those appointments to be heard and debated. I think that's undeniable that we would have benefited from a debate about Merrick Garland, a hearing where we got to hear him talk and hear him be questioned. And then if they wanted to vote no at that point, then, you know, so be it. I'm not sure you can fully take politics out of this. Maybe it's not better, but at least it's more open and transparent. And I think we're all better for openness and transparency within the government. I think the other thing to do is to just assume that if the appropriate chamber fails to provide notice that they've withheld their consent, that like let's say within 90 days, that we just assume that consent's been given, right? I think one of the issues here is that the Senate acted as if they were on recess. They refused to do the thing that they were supposed to do. They were, at least for appointment purposes, effectively on recess. And I think we should have treated them that way. I honestly would have liked to see Obama sort of take that line, and they would have to take that to court, but put that question to the Supreme Court to say, I've exercised my constitutional duty. If they're not going to exercise their constitutional duty, then for purposes of this appointment, they're on recess. I think that's a valid argument that I think we would have been well served by having the Supreme Court weigh in on. I think the other thing we can do, and this is a little bit more gray, I recognize, but I think it's still something that we can entertain, is that we can add a requirement that the consent not be unduly withheld. That's a common clause in contract law. You see it all the time. I see it all the time in contracts that we deal with. And it's ambiguous, no doubt about it, right? Unduly withheld, unreasonably withheld, those are the sort of the terms you typically see. But it's got a long history of judicial interpretation to draw from. And the idea is that the chamber that does not consent to an appointment should be required to point to some reason that's neither pretextual nor political. Now, that could be a previous scandal, it could be a lack of experience, it could even be a controversial position that's demonstrably outside of the mainstream. I do think that the bar to withhold their consent should be at its absolute apex height when trying to claim that the opinion that disqualifies them from the appointment to the position that's in question here is one that the executive ran and won on, right? So I think there's a real problem if the executive runs on a position being opposed to X, whatever that is, right? They are opposed to Martians moving to Venus. Just to pick an absurd example, right? They're opposed to Martians moving to Venus. And then they appoint a Department of Housing that is also opposed to Martians moving to Venus. And the Parliament or Senate or House, whoever's doing this particular appointment, is of a different opinion. They think Martians definitely should move to Venus, right? And so they're going to deny that person, that cabinet position, because they have an opinion that's against their opinion. Well, to me, the president ran on and won on that opinion, and they were clear about that in their election run. Well, that feels to me like that appointment, that's not a valid reason to deny that appointment. So I think that's what I mean by unduly withheld. I think there's sufficient history of contract law to allow us to interpret that correctly. I am a little bit, I'll admit, uneasy with sort of creating something that is, you know, we are making the judiciary the sort of arbiter here, but I don't think that's unreasonable, and maybe that's appropriate. This is one of those where I'm definitely willing to entertain ideas, but I don't think it's good to have the president just be denied his cabinet simply because of politics. That shouldn't happen. There should be a reason to deny somebody a cabinet position. So next time we're going to talk about more about the additional powers of the executive. We're going to talk about how we envision them being elected. And so we'll be doing that on the next episode of Federalist 2.0. We're also going to have our first guest on an upcoming podcast. Hopefully I don't bore him to sleep on air. Thanks, guys. Thanks again for listening to another episode of Federalist 2.0. My name is Jeff. You can reach me at federalistreboot@gmail.com. Please remember to like and subscribe. Apparently, giving 5-star reviews on Apple Podcasts really helps, so if you're using that service, please do that. And until next time, thank you and goodbye.